Okay, well, thanks for joining Things That Matter. I'm John Weston, and I'm particularly excited about the topic tonight and our fantastic panelists. I'm really proud to call them friends, but I think you're going to call them friends too by the time we finish speaking tonight. Each is inspirational, learned, thoughtful, and refreshing. And in addition to those traits, both of the folks on the screen and the third person have a common love for the outdoors and physical exercise. I'm saying that tonight we have, remember the show Two and a Half Men? Well, we have two and a half great panelists. Why? Because Silke Cresswell, who was supposed to be with us tonight, has just been nominated to be Woman of the Year by YWCA. She's at the nomination event this evening. But the good news is she's filmed a great little video this morning for us, which we will show later. Jean Talbot is a rare double doc, combination of physician and PhD, a doctorate in neuroscience. And don't worry, the resume gets even more intimidating as we go. She works at the University of Ottawa Institute of Mental Health Research as a physician scientist. And her research areas of interest are the synergies between ketamine treatment and the psychotherapy of chronic depression and the study of novel non-pharmacological treatments for post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, I speak Chinese, and I think some of that probably came out as a different language. Jean has supervised and taught cognitive behavioral therapy for over 25 years. If you only read her resume, you're probably just be intimidated. But to know the complete Jean, you need to know that while teaching behavioral change around the world, she models her teaching by staying physically, mentally, and spiritually healthy by enjoying a whole bunch of outdoor activities, cycling, skiing, hiking, and paddling with like-minded friends. I've tried to keep up with her on skis and on a bike, and it's not easy. Marco Castamo, you served as an executive in the nonprofit sector for over 20 years. You led the Christian environmentalist organization called Arosha in Canada. You're one of the few persons I know who speaks Nepalese. Have I got that right?
Yeah.
And you played a leadership role at Himalayan Life and tempted me on several occasions to go hiking with you in the Himalayas. Now, I would call that a real hike. And I'm kicking myself because I didn't go, but who knows? You're now with Sanctuary Mental Health, which provides resources that engage the topics of faith and mental health. Sanctuary's content is developed with theologians, psychologists, and people with lived experience of mental health challenges. So Marco, let's go first to you. When I grew up, and pardon my ignorance, but I sort of thought that the mental health thing was one of two. You were either healthy or you were disturbed or troubled. And it seems that we're now in a world where we recognize there's more of a spectrum, that each person is working with different issues. And I'd just like you to comment on that. Is it a black and white, polarized, and excuse the pun, world, or is it something more nuanced?
Thanks, John. Well, first of all, such a privilege to be on the show with you and Jean. Thanks for having me. And secondly, just wanted to say before I answer your question, that if this was a cooking show podcast, it's like you've invited the eater. I'm the eater that came to the show instead of the chef. I come with that lived experience with mental health journey. I live with bipolar 1 disorder. So my feedback will be coming from the kind of lived experience journey and then my work with Sanctuary Mental Health. And to answer your question, John, at Sanctuary, we talk a lot about the mental health continuum. So you may live without any mental health issues or illness. And then on the far horizontal scale, you might live with a severe mental illness. And on a vertical axis, we have perhaps flourishing and languishing at the bottom. So you might live without any mental illness and be languishing at some point in your life. And you might live with mental health challenges or a mental illness and be flourishing. So that encompasses all of us on that spectrum or continuum.
That's really interesting. And those are terms that I've never used before in my understanding of mental health. I'm wondering, Gene, how does that resonate with you and your teaching, your practice? Are those words that you use, or do the concepts make sense?
Absolutely. And first of all, I want to say thank you for inviting me tonight, John. I feel like we're just continuing a conversation that we began years and years ago when we first met. So thank you. And I will say, Marku, I am certainly not a chef. Anyone who knows me will say that I am certainly no chef. In fact, I sit here, with multiple roles, including being a Canadian, like every Canadian who is impacted by mental illness, family, friends, in very close proximity. So I sit here speaking through that lens as well. So I think that I like how you describe sort of the languishing versus flourishing. And, you know, it brings up this issue of the notion of mental health versus mental illness. And, you know, you can be mentally ill but have mental health. And you can have, you know, and I'm going to give an example of this. It's something I would share with my students. Early on in my career, I was covering an inpatient unit, and I was talking to a woman with OCD. She was a mom who had presented to the police department because she was convinced she was a pedophile. In fact, she had OCD, and her intrusive thought was that she was a pedophile. And so the police very sensibly brought her to the psychiatric hospital. So we're chatting, and she asked me about some TV shows. And I said, oh, I never heard of them. And she says, then she asked me about some bands. No, never heard that music. And then she looks at me and she says, you know, Dr. Talbot, it's a Friday night. It's 8 p.m. You're not aware of these TV shows that most of my friends are aware of. You don't know music. How's your mental health? And I thought, yeah, right? It was just a beautiful exchange, but I think it really highlights here what we're talking about, right? She had severe OCD, but I wasn't showing much mental health.
Isn't that interesting? Well, this whole notion of languishing, flourishing, I think I'm going to be thinking about this a long time after tonight's discussion. Does either of you want to elaborate on that? What does languishing look like? What does flourishing look like?
Well, I can speak from my own experience. I think languishing might not always look like what you think it looks like. Languishing could look like, from the outside, if I'm hypomanic, so with bipolar one disorder, I have a cycle, and I am medicated, and I managed this, but I do have a cycle between hypomania or mania on the high end, and then on the low end, some level of depression. So I try to stay in the middle as much as I can through lifestyle management, sleep management, medication, community engagement. Those are all things that help me, being in nature, being active. So languishing could look like two things for me. One could look like I'm just getting a lot done. And you might not be able to tell that I'm kind of hypomanic. I'm on the high end of things. And from the outside, it could look like, he's unbelievably productive. He's entrepreneurial. That's amazing. If you dig a little bit further, you might find out that actually some of the relationships around him aren't doing that well. Other people might not be doing well. He says he's doing really well. I'm the best I've ever been, could be a repeating line. Or languishing could also look like really having a hard time getting out of bed. I have this weight on my chest that is just so heavy. it feels physical. And I'm really foggy. I'm not thinking clearly. And I feel like I'm moving in slow motion. And it's just all I can do to get out and go for a walk or, you know, get out. But it's the best thing for me to do is to push back on both of those. To get to a place of flourishing means pushing against what I'm experiencing, actually. If I'm on the high side, I need to calm myself down. I need to take more quiet walks, not watch any action flicks. There's all, you know, and then if I'm on the low side, I need to get up and dance, listen to some music, go talk to friends, engage with community. So those are two examples of languishing, but also how do I move back towards flourishing?
I suppose this is a hallmark of a great conversation because you are causing to pop in my head more questions than you're providing answers. The questions that are popping in my head, and Jean, I'll let you respond in just a sec, but okay, so I'm starting to question my own situation. You raised the classic case of a person who's asked, how are you doing? And a person who's not doing well is likely to say, oh, I'm doing great. I mean, I literally just walked into a wall last week. And so I probably shouldn't do this. If I was still a politician, I never would. But there it is. There's my, what happened when I walked into a wall? What happened? I'd gone for a swim, came out of a pool, and was distracted, was thinking about actually tonight's session. And I actually walked into a cement pillar. And as the blood started to geyser, the woman behind the desk says, are you okay? And I said, of course, I'm just fine. Do you need help? Not at all. Well, in fact, I wasn't okay and I needed help. But you know, isn't that a classic response? Was I going to say, no, I just walked into a pillar and I need help? No. I want to ask both of you, and Jean, you know, please respond to Marco's comments too, but how do you know when you're not flourishing and you're really languishing? Jean?
Well, that's a big question. And, you know, I don't know that sometimes we're just right smack in the middle. You know, I think what you said, Marco, was very interesting is often it's our loved ones who will tell us, you know, if we're not fortunate enough to be calm enough and sort of connected to how we're feeling and have that insight, then the next thing we can hope for is to have loved ones who will tell us, hey, you know, who will sit us down, look us in the eye and say, listen, I've been noticing this lately. And often if we have a recurring pattern, we can actually set that up in our environment so that we've given permission to our loved ones to say, hey, I've just been noticing that you've been watching a lot of Netflix lately. Is that one of your early signs? And that type of discussion. So I think, John, your point is good. Sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes we can be the last to know. Mm-hmm. But for a lot of patients that I've seen, because I've spent most of, I'm doing primarily research right now, but most of my career I've spent as a clinician. And most people arrive in a lot of distress. They know they're not doing well.
Mm-hmm. But I've always found that when I'd been low, and it doesn't happen often, but when it does, I'm least likely to reach up. So when I'm at my most, to use your word, flourishing, Marco, you know, I'm most likely to talk to people and let them know how I'm feeling. And so there's a cruel irony here. I've got a great wife, Donna, who's my partner in so many different ways. And you know, if I'm at my best, then I'm really transparent. And when I'm not, then, and when I probably most need that help, I'm not. So is that something that you both find to be a common issue in this mm-hmm. discussion?
Yeah, I It is. And I just wanted to go back to what you were saying as well, Gene, and then come back, John, that mirroring by people around you, your community or your family, is so important and critical. And I would say that even in a leadership context, having been a leader and lived, you know, walked a mental health journey in the midst of a leadership paradigm, and not knowing, like, you know, I lived with bipolar 1 disorder for 20 years without knowing, like not being diagnosed. We thought the diagnosis was depression, seasonal depression, until I had the very first manic episode. My only manic episode to this date. But that was really confusing and disorienting in the leadership context, because nobody knew, including myself, what was going on.
Mm.
But I think now in the context that I work and live in now, I am able to say I have these patterns, even in the leadership and vocational context, to say, to be open and vulnerable enough to say that this is my journey, and that there is times where repair needs to happen relationally, especially from, if I'm on the hypomanic side, could have easily hurt somebody in that context relationally. So it needs humility. And I think what you were saying, John, is our tendency is not to reach out when we're feeling low. Mm. And I think that's true. That is the tendency. Mm-hmm. But living with bipolar disorder, when I'm not flourishing and I'm high, my tendency is to reach out to everybody I used to know, they don't even care about me, but I'm calling them. Mm-hmm. So there, it can go both ways, but just notice, I'm just talking about languishing as being high as well as being low.
Mm-hmm. I, and Gene, I'm sure you got lots to respond to that, but let me first jump in and say that because you're willing to share this very special experience of yours, Marku, you are a great teacher. You have so much to share and impact with that most people wouldn't. They wouldn't be courageous enough, I don't think. And you are, and it's fantastic, especially because people who've known you in your various vintages look up to you so much. And now you're saying, boy, I'm not only vulnerable, but, you know, I had this episode that you talk about so freely, and you make it seem an accessible thing, which I think is really great.
It's leadership. It's leadership.
Yeah, really.
I'll just comment on what you talked about, John, of that tendency to withdraw when your mood drops. And, you know, that's such a natural phenomenon. And some of the parallel in the animal world is that when an animal is injured, they'll tend to withdraw. And that's the healing. You know, there's this withdrawing, this sort of slow shutting down, and healing occurs in that way. But with clinical depression, that works against people. And, you know, Marku can talk more about that. And so there is this sort of tendency to withdraw. It's very hardwired. We withdraw. Withdrawing cuts us off from the sources of reward and satisfaction that normally keep our mood okay. And so what Marku was saying was exactly that, is learning that when he feels the impulse to withdraw, he has to push against that. And then conversely, when the impulse is to be very expansive, pull back on that. So what you're describing, and that's one level, like hardwiring level. But I'd also add another level, is our internalized stigma about feeling low. And that we have this sense that it's, or we can often have a sense, and this is the tragedy of the state of mental illness, that feeling low and not being able to get out of bed is a sign of personal weakness.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Hmm. Wow.
And that can also prevent us from making the steps that we need to feel better.
Hmm. So let's talk about that in the context of the pandemic. For all that time, people were isolated. They were on their own. If you started off alone, you were alone a lot more than you maybe ever wanted to be. I would have said that even the most optimistic, energetic, healthy persons would have declined in their mental health in as a generalization. And the people who already started off with challenges would have had a worse time because of that imposed isolation. Now, there's a Globe and Mail article that was on the front page today, interestingly enough, that suggested it wasn't as bad as we might have instinctually thought, that the evidence is that perhaps humans were resilient and responded better. I think other studies will come probably with contrary results. What is your thoughts about isolation and community? I mentioned Kathy Peters' experience taking her whole family living on a boat, being with people she loved. Jean, I know you hang out with three women that were all originally in Ottawa at one point, which I like to call the four Amazons, and you give and get joy from that experience, from that friendship. Marku, I know that you hang out with a bunch of guys sometimes on a Tuesday morning, and that also gives you some sort of, I think, some energy. What are your comments on isolation and how do you overcome it? What if you're just naturally shy? And what do you do about that? Especially in a world where people are being trained that you find your friends online. You don't go out and actually spend time with them.
Hmm. Well, John, I just want to say that there are a lot of studies that are showing that the mental health has deteriorated during the pandemic. And as you said, those who already had poor health fared worse. But most alarming, the sort of the 15 to 24 year old age group appears to have done the worst. And again, the final word's not out. The studies are still being done. So it did have an impact, no doubt.
Hmm. Well, can you go beyond that? Then, you know, would the term be normative? What do you do in your life to not only be mentally healthy in terms of your relationships, but also support other people? I think mm-hmm. there's two parts to the question there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just going to coming back to isolation or not isolation, the other side of the coin, the need for connection. Mm-hmm. And long before the pandemic, we did not need the pandemic to learn this. Mm-hmm. Literature, there's millennial of wisdom about the fact that we are social creatures and that we survive and we thrive within social context, within a range, right? There, you know, there's a range, as you said, personality, introvert, extrovert, but that's how we do best. And I quote the study, and I'm blanking on the name of the author. It's the longest longitudinal study out of Harvard. I'm sure you know which one I mean, but when they looked at two cohorts of young men, and now I think they're in their 80s, the number mm-hmm. one factor that predicts mental health and physical health is their connection to others. I love that study. I love that finding. There were a whole bunch of other findings, but this mm-hmm. is related to what we're talking about. So it's essential. So that's that first part, and maybe I'll stop there and let Marku speak to your second question there.
Yeah, I've stumbled across that study before too, and it is very cool that they kept track of all those people for so long and have such a rich mine of data with that very interesting conclusion. Marku.
Yeah, I think Jean, I just appreciate what you're bringing so much. And again, just speaking from my own experience, And I think women generally, I mean, this is too broad of a generalization, but women tend to have more deeper relationships, and men tend, at least in Western culture, have less deep relationships. I'm an extrovert. I need connection. My favorite thing is to have deep conversations like that. Literally, that's what gets, and they need to be, they're okay on Zoom, but way better in person.
Oh, absolutely.
And I don't know, Jean, there's something about the, you know, mirror neurons and like just that, like having that reflected back to you, what you're saying. And, you know, part of my mental health journey and trauma and childhood trauma, and then experiencing bipolar disorder, living with bipolar disorders, that I've had a hard time attuning to people. Like attunement has been one of my challenges. Mm. And what's been the biggest thing is embodied listening, listening to people, being able to sense with my body. And I think this is a part of that journey of, you know, being with people and listening to people, but not just listening, really hearing them. For me, that's been about actually being able to sense it in my body, to be able to tune in a much, you know, I'm still on a learning journey around that, but that's been a really rich thing. And one of the things that I recently led at Sanctuary Mental Health, we've created the Sanctuary course for communities. It could be just a community of friends, or it could be a faith community. But it's an 8-session video series with a discussion group, discussion guide. And you do this, and I led it for our faith community with 8 people. And it's all rooted in lived experience and hearing people's lived experience around mental health, and then talking about it. And I know that this is, you know, I've experienced group therapy as well, but this was something different. People voluntarily coming to listen to each other. And I was literally in tears every time. And it was this, and it was on Zoom, but it was being heard and then listening to others. And not that everyone had mental illnesses. People were coming as caregivers, as, you know, friends, as parents, but to be able to journey together and dialogue around mental health challenges. It was so rich. And hearing people's stories.
I think you're really putting beautiful words to that fundamental human quality that we look for with other people. And that is to be seen and to be felt. Because and it's such a basic human thing. When we're isolated, that's a lot of the models of depression actually are based on the idea that it's based on a loss of social connection or social roles. Marco, you may know of the interpersonal psychotherapy model of depression. And it's basically that says, you know, oftentimes, not exclusively, when someone becomes depressed, it's because there's been this loss of a role that we play in society or that we play in our life, right? We become a parent, our kids go, we retire, or we change jobs, or we lose someone close, or we have a conflict with somebody important, and in that, we're losing that connection. And that all of these are often what is going on when depression hits. And so speaking to this fundamental property of our brain to be connected to others. But like you said, John, you know, not everyone has that same need. Our brains we're all very diverse. And so some weather the pandemic relieved that they didn't have to go out to functions. Mm. You know, the introverts of the world said, yes.
Well, you're talking about the diversity in humans and how, you know, there's no cookie cutter. I get that.
Exactly. And so I had a colleague who would often say, there's a big difference between being alone and being lonely. And I think that that's such a beautiful distinction, because there's a lot of good that comes from being alone. Mm-hmm. We can become more connected with ourselves, or like you're saying, Marku, with our body, and become more connected. And when we're more connected with our body, only then can we become more connected with us. So being alone is good, but it's finding what works for each of us.
So we're going to come back in a second to the connected with body and physical activity and that. But I want to pause for a second and think about youth. Tom, one of our audience members, is describing a condition that I think we're all aware of. He's friends with a track and field coach who's coaching a bunch of young guys. And not one of them, not a few of them, but all of them are diagnosed with ADHD. Mm-hmm. So, why does this seem to be such a sweeping kind of a condition? I guess I learn increasingly from my own children, and my children, I'm mixing concepts here, I'm sure, but my children, each of them has known or been friends with someone who took their own life. So I'm thinking to myself, wow, I mean, I got to roll up my sleeves and do something about this. Here we've got ADHD seems to be a plague, and then mental health issues in young people seem to be something I never really was aware of. I didn't know anybody who took their own life when I grew up. So and I realize I just probably touched them on two vastly different questions, but can we think of the young people in our lives right now and maybe share with our audience some thoughts about ADHD and mental health in young people?
Well, I'm not an ADHD expert, so I'm just going to start with that, but say that there is an increase in referrals for ADHD consultations. And there are many ideas about what that could be due, just a general raising of awareness of mental illness. There's also social media. On TikTok, for instance, a lot of people are talking about their ADHD and how being treated has helped. And this has given a lot of people a lot of hope that their struggles might be answered the same way. So that's just two. So I think that's a whole topic for another show, John.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Marku, any thoughts?
Well, I can just say anecdotally with our work at Sanctuary Mental Health, we're in the process of creating a youth resource. And these are pretty extensive development phases for us. They're, you know, creating a resource can take up to 2 years. And as soon as we started talking about it, like everyone's knocking on the door, like when can we have this? About 200, I think to date, 230,000 people have participated in the Sanctuary course. And we know that as soon as we have the youth resource available, they're all free resources online. So I was going to say it's going to fly off the shelves, but that makes it sound like we're making, it's all funded through donors to make all these resources available for free. Mm-hmm. But I just know anecdotally, there's a huge pent up demand for that type of resources. And certainly they're one of highly regarded organization, jack.org, works with youth, and they have a lot of resources for youth. So that's one place people can go to mm-hmm. specifically for youth-based resources right now.
Well, that's really helpful. I know there's some young people on the line, Anita in Taiwan, Mei Mei in Boston, so and others. So that I'm sure that will be helpful to them. Another question just came in from Nelson. This is interesting. He says that he's friends with two mentally ill people who have always said that the problems in their lives are other people's fault. How to help them, how to deal with them. I'm glad that I don't have to answer that question, but Jean Marcoux, how would you answer it?
Well, that's human nature often, right? It's a lot easier to find fault with someone other than ourselves. Often that's too painful. But it does make it difficult for often for the people around us, and it does delay our making meaningful change.
Go ahead, Jean.
But one of the basic principles of sort of human nature is the more we push someone to get help, the more they will push back against us. And if so, we is finding that sweet spot of sort of acknowledging their distress, right? It seems like you're very upset about XXX. Seems like you're very distressed. You know, sometimes there can be help with distress. But not in to get them help, because they'll fight you rather than their inner fight, which is there really something going on with me, or is it really them?
Interesting. Marco?
Thank you for that, Jean. I think in my own experience, that's all been true. And first of all, I want to just to Nelson say thank you for being a friend. I think that's one of the key things, is to continue being a friend in the midst of difficulty and difficult relationships. And I do think that I'm completely on board with taking responsibility, and that change won't happen. I agree with you, Jean, until for me, that has been true and is true, that I'm constantly needing to take responsibility for my actions, my thought patterns, the way I engage. And again, to do that without coming back to that word stigma, without self-stigma, you know, and being able to say, okay, I messed up. Mm-hmm. Hey, I can keep going. Mm-hmm. Rather than spiraling in sort of that shame or self-stigma. I think those things, that does relate to Nelson's question, that there is stigma around mental health. And so, but that at the same time, there's this self-stigma that I think for me is coming to awareness of that and owning that has been a really big step towards a part of my recovery, ongoing recovery. So.
Another language for this, I think, Marco, is self-compassion.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, often if we haven't had a good dose of that growing up from those who were charged with caring for us, as adults, we don't know how to relate to ourselves in that way. And often that's we need to relate to ourselves in that way first in order then to be able to tolerate the shame and the discomfort which comes with then taking responsibility for some of our behaviors and our words that are not helping us or others.
Yeah.
Both of you have talked about physical activity a little bit. You're both very keen about outdoors recreation and the various things that you love to do. Silke Cresswell, who wanted to be with us tonight, but for good reasons isn't, is a movement disorder neurologist. Now, I bet you, if you're me, you didn't know that there was such a thing as a movement disorder neurologist, but Silke is it. She is the founder of the Brain Wellness Foundation. She teaches at UBC. She's got a background in outdoors recreation herself. She does clinical and research work focusing on holistic interdisciplinary approaches for physical and emotional well-being. And she has prepared for us this video insight that I'd like to play for us now. See if we can bring it up. And here we go, Silke.
Hi, my name is Silke Creswell. I'm a neurologist and a clinician scientist. My clinical and research work focuses on movement disorders, Parkinson's disease, and other neurodegenerative disorders. And I very much thank John for inviting me to be with you tonight. And unfortunately, I can't for reasons beyond my control. So I'm just recording this and we'll focus on one question, which is the relationship of exercise to mental health. And I'm particularly interested in exercise, but also nutrition and other lifestyle factors, really our life choices and how they are related to mental health and cognitive health. And it's very clear that the research supports this left, right, and center. Exercise and movement is very much related and is helpful for mood. It is helpful for cognition and the risk of developing neurodegenerative disorders such as Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's later on. Point number one is for sure exercise is very, very helpful in this regard, obviously always paired with several other interventions as well. It's not the only thing to do, but it's a very important thing. I liken it to the foundation of our well-being. And thinking about exercise and also healthy eating and, for example, the risk of Parkinson's disease, a large study with over 120,000 people, of which then 1,200 developed Parkinson's over 30 to 40 years, looked at mortality. So dying during the course of the study from Parkinson's disease. And it turns out that if you exercise, you are 40% less likely to die from Parkinson's, the people who had Parkinson's, over the follow-up of the study. And the people who were exercising and eating healthily were about two-thirds, 65% less likely to die from Parkinson's during that follow-up period, which I think is probably about the hardest outcome you can choose, mortality. So that's pretty a pretty strong relationship or correlation there. And when we talk about healthy diet, this is really what our grandmother would have told us is healthy. You know, lots of fresh fruit and vegetables, whole grains, and then paired with nuts and seeds. Berries are particularly good, fish, and then cut down on all the processed stuff, the fried food, the red meat, the sweets. Not that you can't ever have them, but just really make this a much, much smaller portion compared to all the healthy things. And in clinic, to be honest, I see this all the time. The people who are leading a healthy life, who are moving a lot, who are exercising, who are eating healthily, who are cognitively, socially, creatively active, who are engaged in life, they're doing better. Some of them literally are years younger because of all of that. So Dr. Jack Taunton, who might actually even be on the call tonight, so hi, Jack, and I founded the BC Brain Wellness Program, and it was launched in 2019. It was an in-person program at the time. Little did we know that half a year later in March 2020, the pandemic would hit and we all would have to go online, which we did within 2 weeks. And that then led to an unexpected explosion of participants. From initially 75 in people participants or person participants, we have reached over 2,000 participants since across the province and have offered over 3,000 hours of free programming in the ranges of exercise. There are different levels of exercise depending on the needs of the participants. There are how to cope best living with the chronic conditions classes. There are creative and expression classes, arts-based practices, anything from music to improv theater to visual arts to writing groups. And this is all free thanks to generous donors and thanks to the support of several foundations, including the BGH UBC Hospital Foundation and the UBC Development Office. And so we're very, very grateful for that. And we have, of course, collected feedback from our participants. And it turns out that both physical and mental health and community were the three big themes in that. They go together. These benefits usually come together. I joke and say people come for the exercise and they stay for the community and the mental health, but they also feel better physically. And this has been, the participants could say this in a much more compelling way than I can, because it's their lived experience. It really has been a lifeline for many during the pandemic, and quite life-changing, as many have been attesting. And those many are both people living with chronic conditions as well as their care partners, because those usually fall through the cracks, and then also healthy ages. And taking all of this together, my simple message really is to make sure that the foundations of well-being are in place. So movement and exercise, healthy, wholesome nutrition, getting enough sleep, spending time in nature, being part of a community, tending to your psychological and spiritual health, being creative. And with all of that, I wish you a very good podcast tonight. Cheers.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, Silky couldn't join us because she's being nominated for Women of the Year by YWCA, and she's at an event tonight. She was instrumental in defining the words health and fitness for the Canadian Health and Fitness Institute. Monica Yacko, who's on the line today, will attest how influential she's been in our charitable foundation. Any thoughts on what Silky had to say? She covered a lot in a short time, didn't she?
Yeah, she said it very, very well. I wouldn't add much other than the notion is it's the movement. It's movement. It's not one of the resources that I recommended is called Blue Zone. I don't know if you've heard about this organization that's looked at longevity across the world, pockets of longevity, and isolated 9 factors that play into that. And when we're talking about longevity, it's clearly mental and physical well-being. And the key was not fitness, but movement, and movement incorporated into their everyday. So these are people who often didn't do any exercise, but they would be climbing 4 flights of stairs every day because they're living on a cliff, or they're chopping wood at 95. And so it was incorporated in to their life. But there were so many other factors, like Silky was saying, in terms of the connections with others. One of the ones that I liked is all of these groups had built into their life a time where they would step out of the busyness of life on a weekly basis for religious reasons or for culture reasons. They step out. No matter what's going on, they step out. And they are quiet.
Wow, that's very interesting. That's the Sabbath idea in Jewish and Christian heritage. And
exactly.
Yeah. Huh. And by the way, we're going to come to your recommendation in a second. So stay tuned, everybody. Jean's recommendations and Marku's picks and Sophie's pick. You're not going to want to miss that. We'll get back to that. Marku, any thoughts that were stirred by Sophie's thoughts?
Oh, well, both Jean and Silky have said it so well. The only thing I would concur is that stepping out, like all of it, yes, and movement and activity, yes, those are huge. But also sleep, for me, sleep is like baseline. And I would also say, actually, for people with severe mental illnesses, like the medication is essential. So it's a part of that being, being well is, and that's a part of it. It's kind of like someone who suffers from a migraine and you tell them, go exercise. Well, actually, maybe if they took some meds, their headache would be in such a place, in a zone where they could actually go out and do something. Mm-hmm. So just a simple illustration of sometimes medication gets a bad rap.
I think you also bring up, I remember early on in my career, the data for exercise to treat, mild to moderate depression is very strong. And so there I was in all my enthusiasm as a young clinician telling these very busy young parents that if they wanted to help their depression, they needed to get out and do some exercise. And they just looked at me, rightly so, like I was missing the boat, because they're working full time, they're battling traffic. They're running to make meals. They're getting kids to hockey. And I'm suggesting that on top of all of that, they should find time to exercise. And they rightly told me that that was a bit of a lack of attunement, that I just needed to understand what their life was. And I think that that message was very important, because it's not exercise, it's movement. And it's things that bring you a sense of pleasure, satisfaction, connection, as small as that may be. Because they were misinterpreting, and maybe not misinterpreting, my message: get out into the gym, go out and run. You know, when we say exercise, that's what they had in mind, but it's not that. And this blue zone really highlights that.
Wow, you're making me want to make a tour of 9 places in the world.
I'll join you. I will join you for that.
All right. Well, let's turn to what you have recommended for people who want to telescope beyond tonight's conversation and look at other things. We're going to look at what we call your picks. So hopefully this is visible on your screen. And Jean, we'll start with your picks. Why don't you take us through these things that you have recommended for people who tuned in this evening?
Well, we've talked a lot about stigma tonight, and often that can be a challenge for people seeking mental health. But if you are interested in seeking mental health for yourself or for others, Wellness Together is it is a resource put together by the Canadian government in collaboration with others. And through that, you can get access to resources, peer-to-peer support, as well as counselors for mental health issues, as well as addictions across the age range. So we were talking about youth earlier. This is a resource also. Blue Zone, I just mentioned it. It's just talking about these guiding principles, 9 common guiding principles that we have learned about by studying the healthiest, happiest, longest living people on the planet. And because the theme of tonight was leadership, and yesterday was International Women's Day, I recommended Eleanor Roosevelt's a book about her leadership. And what a tremendous woman she was in terms of overcoming her own mental health issues and becoming such a strong advocate for people's mental and physical well-being. Mm. So those are mine.
Good picks. And don't worry, folks, we will post these as a separate item on the website later if you care to come back. Let me see if we can get to yours. Marku, you were way more succinct than me or Jean. Tell us about these two.
Okay, well, actually, I'm going to throw in a book first, and that's by Kay Redfield Jamison and Unquiet Mind. She's a bipolar researcher and a psychologist, and also lives with bipolar disorder, and just is an amazing writer and storyteller, and tells her own story in such a compelling and poetic way, and opens our eyes to her journey. So just encourage that book. Vincent van Gogh's painting, The Starry Night. I mean, most of you will know this image, the swirling night sky with stars, painted from a psychiatric facility, Saint Remy, in Arles in Provence in southern France, at the height of Van Gogh's production, really, like, and most likely, not 100% sure, but most likely in the midst of mania at the time. And so having been there and, you know, in the location, and then knowing his journey, it's just been this sort of, you know, for me, a journey into my own lived experience and how that highlights. So if you go to my Facebook page, it's there. And then I just wanted to end with the Mary Oliver. If you don't know this poet, you should go read her. Take some time out, as Jean was suggesting, and contemplate Mary Oliver and her words. And I think, throw in some movement. One of my favorite ways of being active, I like a lot of things, but being the movement that I have daily rhythms of is taking my dog for a walk in the woods. And I reflect on this poem when I am among the trees. I've been chewing on this one for the last couple of weeks. And the last phrase is, "And they call again," that's the trees. "It's simple," they say, "and you too have come into the world to do this, to go easy, to be filled with light, and to shine."
I love that you picked a poem and a poet. Mary Oliver also asked, "What will you do with your one wild and precious life?" That's in a different poem. And we have a great production team that helps me put this together. There's Elliot Harada, there's Amber Zhao, and there's Dana McLeod. Dana is also a professional musician. And so when she saw your pick, Marku, she burst into Starry, Starry Night by Don McLean, is it? I think so. Anyway, great picks. Thank you for those. Silky gave us three books, and she's not here. And unfortunately, I don't know the books, but it's interesting. One of hers is a cookbook. So she talked about nutrition. And if you look this up on Amazon, a beautiful cover to the Complete Mediterranean Cookbook, probably a nice gift for someone else, if not for yourself. And she's got two other books here. Interesting, a faith leader, Dalai Lama, co-authored with Howard Cutler, the first one on her list. And then she's got this other book, Matthew Lieberman, Social. So I hope you'll forgive me. I went a little over the top because I just found today's topic so intriguing, and I knew you would come with so many provocative and inspiring thoughts, even though you violently agreed with each other on so many things. So I mentioned Kathy Peters' book earlier in the show, Family Sails Away, and I think that you would love this book about what she did creating community. Famous film way back to 1981. The director just passed away a couple of weeks ago, Hugh Hudson. A book about faith and exercise and sticking to your principles. It's a film, of course. You may wonder why I chose it. I just thought that the music is fantastic. There's so many inspiring things about this film that I wanted to bring it up in this context. And you brought a poem, so I brought a poem. Mine goes way, way, way back to 1895 when Rudyard Kipling wrote the poem, If. And one of the things I do to keep my mind alive is I memorize. So I'm memorizing If as we speak. And it really helps, I find, in terms of mental acuity. I mean, one thing we didn't talk about tonight, and maybe this is a whole other show, is the effect of social media on mental health. And two works that really dive into this are the film Social Dilemma, which is on Netflix, which profiles people who were leaders in the social media world at Facebook, Google, and other well-known mega companies who won't let their kids tune in. They are really remarkable and strident in their concerns about mental health as related to social media. So alert to everybody on the call tonight, especially young people, but also a new book, a 2022 book by Maria Ressa, who was CNN's Southeast Asia anchorwoman. She's a Filipino, stands 5'2" and has gone basically toe-to-toe with Duterte, the Filipino president. Her book is How to Stand Up to a Dictator, but it's also about how social media is used to suborn our mental health and our information. I highly recommend the book. Might surprise you, I threw in a book, which is one of the most surprising books in the whole Bible, by Job, and he asks the tough questions. He's been put in a horrible situation where he loses his children and all of his flocks of cattle and everything he owns, including his health. And he's asked to deny God and he holds firm and he says, no, I'm not doing that. And I don't understand why all of this is happening to me, but I'm still going to look forward. It's a remarkable book. And I hope I don't offend anyone by saying this, but it's such a Jewish book in that it asks really tough questions, and it's honest and it's real. And so if you're new to the Bible, this is a surprising one. You won't expect to find that book there. And then finally, this foundation, I'll confess, just full disclosure, I've poured so much energy and time, along with great people, Gene, you're one of them, other people are on the call today, to try and make Canada the fittest nation on earth by 2030, because I think we're living well below our potential in mental health, physical health, and spiritual health. And so if you care to look at what we're doing there, check out chfi.fit. Fantastic conversation. I wish we had three more hours, but we're going to bring it to a close now with my fulsome gratitude. Marku, Gene, you impact people every day of your lives, and you did it tonight once again in a very different way. So thank you.
A real pleasure. Marku, good night.
Good night. Thank you, Gene, and thanks, John.
Thank you, John.
Bye, all. Bye, everybody. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for joining.
Thank you.